Hello, and welcome again to the Ecosystemic Futures podcast, presented by NASA's Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project in collaboration with ShoshimWorks, a global firm helping organizations and nations navigate ecosystemic transformation. As our world is increasingly digital and interconnected, ecosystemic models are reshaping society, industry, economy, and policy, and reframing how we build for resilient futures. Today, we're examining how ecosystemic models are transforming one of the world's most economically inefficient industries, and why these new frameworks for orchestrating complex networks of stakeholders, incentives, and value creation offer critical lessons for space missions, where traditional linear models often fail to function. I'm Diane Finkhausen, CEO of ShoshimWorks, and joined today by our guest, Dr. Rawa Amar, Chief Sustainability Officer and Impact Officer at ResortEx. Rawa, let's start with your background and what led you from environmental sciences to revolutionizing how we capture economic value from complex systems.
Thanks, Diane, for having me here. Very excited for this discussion today. Yes, indeed. So maybe to start a little bit, a hint of my background, I'm a scout girl, close to the nature, really understand processes, really raised in a small village. That's why it kind of dictated my study line. And I did my PhD in environmental science, and that followed by a postdoc on also, if you will, I call it natural decarbonization, which is basically the carbon absorption by ocean, the natural carbon withdrawal by ocean, and how it's impacted by biogeochemical processes. So I was very deep in sciences, I would say, and research, but then I felt I need to do a little bit more. It was a great journey being a researcher on the lab bench and trying to work with algae and try to find those heavy metals in and measurements and radioactive traceability. And even I taught in the university, but I felt I need to see faster results because we need change and we need it now. So I did this shift and moved into entrepreneurial life, where I really put all my energy in a very interesting project about circularity to solve one of the biggest problem, or one of the top biggest problems, I would say, in our world today, that is underrepresented, the textile industry. And when I say textile, it's indeed fashion and apparel, but it's not limited only for fashion apparel, but textile in the general way of thinking. Try to find a solution to shift thinking and help the transition of this vital industry.
Yeah, what a fascinating journey from literally environmental sciences to orchestrating what we refer to as ecosystemic transformation in the textile industry. And if we can maybe double click into that journey, and what was that moment where you realized that achieving circularity wasn't really just only about better technology and science, but also fundamentally about kind of rewiring some of the broader relationships, incentive systems, and information flows, basically that flow between or that connect all stakeholders in an entire value chain. And when did you make that shift, and how did you make that shift?
So I started my journey at ResortEx in 2019. And the reason was the reason why I joined basically is when I understood how much the system is broken, right? With being one of the top four most polluting industries, highly intense resource, it needs a lot of water, it needs a lot of land, it causes a lot of pollution, up to 8 to 10% of global CO2 emission, responsible for 20% of global water consumption and pollution. So I felt as an environmental scientist, I need to be part of a journey for a solution for this industry. The real click came in on the job itself. The more we digged in, the more we tried to understand the system, tried to understand this very ramified value chain that expands through so many stakeholders, upstream and downstream, across multinational companies, it spans over, crosses borders, let's say, and try to understand really how it works. And then when we were able to paint this picture, we realized that technology alone cannot do it. Innovation alone cannot do it. We really need to enforce and work on building these bridges of information flow to create what we call the ecosystem, to bring all these key value chain members around the table, because competition, as important as it is in this kind of shift mindset to shift the thinking mindset, they really need to sit down on the table and learn to collaborate, because with collaboration, we will have a more efficient results, and competition remains with playing as normal, but collaboration will benefit us more than just simply working in silos and competing with each other.
That is such an important shift, paradigm shift, really, that can be challenging for a lot of organizations, a lot of folks, right? Really, the balance between the competitive forces in a sector and how to shift to a more collaborative model where you can still maintain the distinctions of the organizational priorities and positioning, but also find a way to work together in ways that drives more economic value and benefit, not only for the organizations themselves, but the broader ecosystem. The numbers, you recently joined us at one of our NASA sessions and shared a lot of the economic impact with us. And the numbers are just extraordinary. And I know we'll get into those, but I was struck by the fact that you mentioned close to $500 billion in economic value is lost annually. There are 100 billion garments produced annually. Some of these numbers are really striking. And to the extent that you can reconfigure the economic models within a system of that scale, the impact could be meaningful, to your point, and frankly, urgent. So your work does reveal really a lot of organizations are still working with traditional linear models where organizations design, manufacture, sell, and walk away. But based on the premise that we're talking about here, they're still leaving massive economic value on the table, potentially. At ResortX, you're pioneering what we refer to an ecosystemic model or a circular model, right? That captures value from the materials and the components that were potentially previously considered waste streams. Can you maybe walk our listeners through the economic opportunity that this represents and how this ecosystemic or circular approach differs from conventional business thinking, so our listeners can kind of take some of these lessons back to their industries, their sectors, their organizations?
Sure. So you mentioned that a lot of financial benefits or lost financial opportunities are left on the table. I would go further and say are dumped in the dump sites, right? So the things that for textile industry, every second, one garbage truck full of textile is wasted somewhere around the globe. So in essence, this huge amount of products, of material value that is worth $500 billion is lost every single year. And what we are trying to do is to kind of reverse engineering this problem of the waste and to try to salvage as much as possible of this critical material. Even if it's cotton, it's not like platinum or gold to call it critical, yet it's critical, especially in these times and days where there's a lot of tension in trade. There's a lot of scarcity sometimes of resources, delays. Cotton becomes not only a simple commodity, it becomes a critical raw material. And that's what the circular system aspiration goes from, to really rethink the whole system and how to bring back, to avoid letting this material go to a waste end of life disposing scenarios, and rather take it upstream for reuse, remake, repair, and recycling, and create value from this material. I will go a little bit further here. You citing a recent UN study that the textile industry is having a risk. So the climate change and this linear system, business as usual, is putting a risk of at 110 billion euros worth of material in the textile industry. And if brands really need to de-risk that, by going, for instance, through this material selection, circularity solutions, embedding and scaling them up, they can save $54 trillion. I mean, this is immense. These are huge numbers. We're not talking about pennies here. So indeed, it's a huge system. When the change is really made and the shift is really made across the processes, across international borders, yeah, a lot of economical benefits can be gained.
It's extraordinary. I mean, these are national level economy levels of impact, right? So I think the recovery rates, that it's interesting to explore this for our listeners who want to take some of these lessons back to their sectors, right, in their organizations. The recovery rates differ pretty significantly across different materials. So I know we're talking about textiles here, but you've also previously compared the recovery rates across different materials, glass, paper, plastics, et cetera. What are some of the characteristics and design choices in garment construction that create inefficiencies that may perhaps not exist or are less than or more than the recovery rates of other materials in other sectors? If you can just maybe help us walk through a high level comparison.
Sure. I mean, if we just take a stable item in any house, I will not go to an office, right? It's just an envelope, a paper envelope or a packaging. It's a monomaterial bag product, right? That's all made of the same paper. Mm-hmm. Can have some impurities if there's a glue or adhesive, but within the tolerance limit to allow for its complete recycling back in a closed loop into paper. So the system complexity there for these types of product is minimal. If you are talking about textile, complexities can differ magnificently in a sense that if we're talking about outdoor jacket, and outdoor jacket contains multi-material for functionality reasons, right? Because we need a rain waterproof outer shell and maybe a nice cozy inside. We need a lot of proper fitting that requires the presence of elastic bands, buttons, zippers, labels, a lot of fittings, what we call them trims. And these trims are not easily removed. So if any recycling needs to take place for this type of garments, which is found in anyone's closet, it requires literally to be manually separated and taken apart to be able to salvage as much as possible of this material. And that's the complexity on the design phase, for example, for a garment. And here where one of the solutions comes, like Resortex solution, is to really solve the problem at the root cause of it, not to wait until it becomes waste, but rather do the paradigm shift of how to rethink the design and how to really take advantage of the power of the design for everyday product.
Yeah, that's such an interesting paradigm shift, which we love here at Ecosystemic Futures. So in a great segue into your solution, the Resortex solution. So let's talk about that. You've talked about basically you have developed what you call active disassembly using innovative materials and design processes. And I think it's just a fascinating concept and interesting how we might be able to extrapolate some of those principles to other sectors, or our listeners can perhaps extrapolate some of those principles to their own sectors. But can you maybe walk us through how active disassembly works and why it's so dramatically more cost effective and profitable than manual or mechanical processing?
Sure. So active disassembly is one of the efficient ways of what we call design for disassembly. So we design product for it to be disassembled when we want it to be disassembled at certain point in time. And in the case of textiles, that would be maybe during repair or even recycling at end of life. One doesn't exclude the other. So we can still design a product that can be repaired and yet is available or made recyclable at end of life to ease the disassembly. Why it's more efficient, right? So what Resortex developed is developed an innovative patented solution based on a very simple hidden player, which is a stitching thread that joins those different parts together. As I mentioned earlier in the example of the outdoor jacket, where we can put the different materials together, where we can sew the zipper to the main body of the product. And then why it's active disassembly? Because it is disassembled by kind of, if you will, something like debonding. When you apply targeted heat to the product, the stitching thread simply melts and liberate everything that was connected together. And therefore, it eases the efficiency of the product. It's not only, it makes it more efficient because it can be done automatically at an industrial scale, because those are two important criteria for scaling the solution and, of course, decreasing the costs and increasing the efficiency of the process. But also, it managed to reduce the waste generated compared to alternative technologies or alternative approaches that are available on the market, by also classical ones, simply like the manual disassembly, just taking a pair of scissors and go around a product, or mechanical disassembly. You can imagine something like a shredder where everything goes together. So in comparison with these approaches, this active disassembly or design for disassembly approach will allow for more efficient process that could be up to 15 times faster than classical processes, can be automated, it can be scaled up, not unlike, for example, manual disassembly. You cannot scale up, you can have as much manual workers as you want, but it will be difficult to scale up into a more financially viable solution. And it, of course, it's the waste generation part of it, which make really the shift, because you will have an output that is kind of accumulating to the right volume required to make the financial benefits work, plus the purity of the feedstock. Because this can be achieved, for example, in mechanical disassembly, to go through tons and tons of product volume. But due to the nature of the process, the quality of the recyclate, what do we call, or the feedstock, will drop, and it drops in value and drops in also narrows down the application for where I can use this feedstock. Can I put it back into a completely closed loop, or then I'll have to rethink putting it in an open loop, like using it in insulation material. So the active disassembly or design for disassembly allow to literally close the loop by enabling textile to textile recycling.
Which has the, just to kind of boil it down, that just has the potential to massively alter the business case, right, for the textile sector, right? Basically taking what is a cost base, a negative impact on the overall economic model, to potentially contributing to back to the profit cycle, right? If you can design this in a way elegantly so that those component materials can be reapplied in other applications, then that could potentially generate additional profits for the overall business model. Yes?
So it will indeed. So it will do two things if we want to talk to the financial balance sheet of the product, right? Mm-hmm. So it will reduce certain costs. For example, the costs of the waste management, mm-hmm. right? So because of the all collection to gate, for the maybe incineration or landfilling costs, that was a cost for municipalities in that case, or sometimes for product owners, if they keep their product's ownership throughout the life cycle of the product, that represents a cost, and it's not a cheap cost. It can go between 100 to 100. I'm speaking here from a euro perspective. You can simplify it to do it like almost $100 to $150 a ton will cost for incineration or landfilling of textile, right? Landfilling sometimes in certain parts of Europe is even more expensive. So you can avoid this cost or reduce it to a minimum, because our process can reduce the waste generation up to 85 to 90%, depending on the type of the product. So that's already avoiding cost. That's the negative on your balance sheet is already omitted. On the other hand, the material you will have, if we want to talk about generally speaking for the whole value chain, right? Not necessarily to one particular stakeholder or in the value chain. So then this material that was worthless because it was waste, now it's becoming a feedstock. So it will have a value. So you can sell it to a recycler. And then when the recycler receive it, they will make a new material from it, and then they will sell it again as a recycled material. With all this benefits not only coming simply like this, because it's also supported by a lot of incentives and subsidies, governmental subsidies to encourage this transition, so you can get a reduction on taxes, and you can get subsidies to implement and buy these kind of alternative sources because you implement recycled material into products. So if you then calculate the whole economical balance sheet of the product, then it become a positive rather than a negative.
I love that. And the beauty of these ecosystemic models, right, and ecosystemic design is that it allows us to look at very broadly at systems of systems, right? So industry, policy, and society. And I love that you touched on the EU kind of regulatory framework. So EU's regulatory framework is, correct me if I'm wrong, essentially beginning to create new market incentives and competitive dynamics around resource efficiencies. And this represents a shift toward what we might call innovation-driven regulation. And this can have the potential of creating economic opportunities rather than just compliance costs, which is so important. So how is this policy driving, from your perspective, market? How is it driving market transformation? What can other regions learn about using regulation to unlock economic value more efficiently?
Sure. It was also mentioned in the webinar, we tried to kind of benchmark the journey of textile industry because it's kind of recent compared to other industries like paper, glass, and plastic bottles, especially PET. So if we look in the hindsight and evaluate how the policy act as a driver and catalyzer to create a momentum for this shift in the other industries and transfer the cost into a profit, we can directly see it in glass, in plastic, and in paper. And that was a huge shift, especially in paper. Nowadays, Europe almost recycle three quarters of its paper waste because the policy put a very ambitious incentives and requirement, for example, in 2008, to have 60% of every product containing recycled paper in it, so recycled content. And this kind of a simple example how the policy really drives innovation, because it doesn't only shift the market, but also drives innovation. And then you have this technological, beautiful spillover from one industry to another to see, okay, what this industry did, how I can leverage their lessons, and how can I learn from these lessons, and I can integrate into my own problems to shift that. If we look into these examples, we can see similarities a lot with plastic. Right? Glass and paper are straightforward, more or less. Plastic is more complicated. If we look into the juice box, right, in our fridge, it's made of this multi-layer products with the labels, with maybe nylon films. It's very complex. So it's in essence, in its structure, it's very similar to garment. And then if we observe the journey of this kind of packaging, we see similarities with the textile industry. Now, maybe to go back to precisely to your question on the regulatory push at our textile industry transition in Europe. Currently, there are 16 different textile regulation to make this shift to have more sustainable and circular textiles in Europe. Some of them are more advanced than others. Definitely, it's creating a paradigm shift. One of the, personally, the beauties that I see apart from the change of mindset of the brands themselves trying to understand how they can create products that can have more longevity, have higher safety, and are recyclable at the end of the day, but also profitable for them, which keep them competitive, which keep them autonomous, and the whole value chain resilient. But one of the interesting things I mentioned earlier about the collaboration. So if you see now across Europe, you will see creating those ecosystems start created at a national level and at European level, where all the stakeholders are trying to join forces to help each other to transfer this information and see how we can make this a win-win for everybody in this value chain. It's not easy journey. It's driven by regulation, because without regulation, it wouldn't have happened. Maybe a couple of visionaries will talk about it over a beer, but that will be it. The regulation really made this push, and we can start seeing it. It's a slow, but we are seeing this transition that the regulation really forced, because at the end of the day, if it doesn't make money, it will not catch fire, right? So it has to make money. It has to make sense for all the value chain for every member and every stakeholder around the table. So to get to that level, the policy can play a lot of role. It can push it by compliance. It can push it by taxation, but also it can push it by subsidies and incentives at the beginning to allow this transition, because the transition is difficult. We have done some work at Resortix, and we know that at the beginning, the investment is negative because it's not at scale. When the economy will work better at a scale, because then economies of scale will really benefit, and then it will subsidize your investment into a really marginal value while your benefits will increase as we go into a scale. And to have this transition, this road would require some patient investment, some subsidies to enable to correct the broken financial case for some partners, to enable them to integrate in this circular system and enable the circularity transition.
So brilliant. So brilliant. And so well explained. Thank you, Rawa. I'm fascinated by, given the kind of digital framework within which we're all operating these days, right? Society, industry, and policy. I'm fascinated by the evolution of the public-private partnership, right? And because of the interconnectivity and the need for these more ecosystemic circular models, that necessarily is aided, I think, much more effectively by an evolved role of the public sector, to your point. And I think you described that perfectly for our listeners. Thank you so much. And I would like to circle back. Speaking of our government, our friends in government, you mentioned the session that we have with the NASA team recently. And we talked about the parallels or the lessons that perhaps some of their sectors can draw from the work that you're doing. And very specifically, I think it would be very interesting for our listeners who are leaning into the space economy, right? If we can kind of explore this just for a moment. In the recent talk with the NASA team, you drew some parallels between terrestrial resource efficiency and some of the challenges faced by space missions, and both face finite resources, complex assemblies, and extreme cost constraints. Can you maybe elaborate on some of these connections for our friends in the space economy and the strategic value that they represent, right? Extrapolating some of those lessons into the challenges faced by folks that are building and innovating and designing for the space economy.
Yeah. So indeed. So it's true that we're talking about terrestrial resources where we imagine it's abundant and infinite. Well, actually, it's not, right? It's finite. Even it seems abundant, yet it's finite. And with different factors that come to play, now it's becoming more and more challenging to access certain sources at a certain times, right? That we need it in this place, but at this time, sometimes it's very challenging even for big brands to get their warehouses filled in the time they want, just because a ship went sideways in the Suez Canal, right? It's silly sometimes to sound, but actually it's true. They had really hard time. A lot of companies had really had hard time because of that. So if we want to draw parallels to the space where the materials are super finite, and what I understood from the team at NASA is that it costs them a lot to bring a single gram up there. So the need is even more exaggerated, is more amplified for the folks that are working in the space, and to understand this economy, not only from just a material availability, but really to kind of make it more efficient, available, timely, because now time is also a cost that we need to factor in.
And there may be no resupply chain, right? If we think about those deep space missions, no resupply is...
No, exactly. So this is the parallel that I try to imagine, that we have a system where the materials are finite. Every single gram is worth to really look into and cherish and keep in the loop as much as possible. The assemblies for these systems, they are complex. So let's say if a rocket returns to the Earth, it tried to extract these valuable material from it. The way it was assembled in the first place made it very complex, even I would dare to say unsafe to unpack and try to extract these valuable material from. The cost, it's huge. Of course, it's not cotton and polyester. The material that they are using for space missions are much more costly, and the resource constraints are even more difficult for them. So just simply trying to think about that. And what I try to imagine, even I have no idea and I cannot interfere into that space as I don't understand it at all. Just see the moon from outside, follow NASA news like a normal citizen. But I try to imagine, as we were talking about textile, I try to imagine the suits, the space station suits for the team, but also the spacesuit itself, the complexity of its design, the value of the material in it. And I would dare to ask, can we design it differently? Can we design it in a such a way that if there was a problem in it up in the space with that astronaut stranded in the space station, are they having the tools and capabilities to kind of fix it on the spot without having a really big problem up there? Or if it returns to Earth and it's out of use, instead of having this end of life with investment that much in it and the value of the material, instead of dumping it in the bin, can we salvage any of its material and put it back into maybe another spacesuit?
Right, exactly. And going through this thought process with you, Rawa, I'm thinking how much of an unlock this could be, not only for product managers, right, but also operational managers, right? So you've shown how this is fundamentally an operational design issue as well. Not simply a materials challenge, but this is product design. This is also operational design for maybe aerospace engineers or really anyone designing missions or operations. What would you want them to understand about creating not just products, but giving themselves the liberty, the freedom to think about entire ecosystems of operational efficiency, information flow, strategic value creation, from day one to day X plus, right? Beyond the traditional asset life value into that next generation of asset, maybe distributed component asset value.
I think there are so many factors to take into account, but I think to start with, and the most important thing is that thinking shift. Thinking shift needs to happen because we need to view the products, not only operation or space mission material, any product. We need to think about it from a life cycle centric design approach. Not only this product, we make it, we break it, we send it to waste. We need to think beyond. We need to think a step further, how we can reintegrate it back into the loop. Can we keep it in the closed loop? Yes. Okay, let's do it. How we can do it? We cannot keep it in the closed loop. Okay, let's venture what we can do it into an open loop, and there where you'll have the beautiful spillovers to another technologies and another benefits for the whole ecosystem to take place from. So this is, I would say, the first thing I would love for engineers and operational managers to start thinking about. And to, yeah, once this is done, then the others will follow, right? Like the value chain collaboration with everybody in the value chain upstream and downstream. And maybe I didn't explain it clearly in the case of Resortix, and where this reality and this realization came is that the solution at Resortix is divided in two parts. The first part is the stitching thread, which is like a kind of a consumable. It goes into the design phase upstream with the brands during the manufacturing and configuration of the product. But then we have the smart assembly system where the magic happens, right? When the product becomes a waste or reach end of life. And that's at the downstream of the value chain where we'll have to inevitably work with collectors, sorters, and recyclers. And this combination, this vintage point we have in this value chain, made it more than ever very important how to understand for this flow of information and collaboration with the different actors across the value chain and the supply chain eventually.
Yeah, I love that I love that point. And your work really reveals that pre-processing is really a silent enabler of value creation, to your point. And we've talked about in the other session as well, you've talked about yield optimization improving 3.3x when combining better collection with strategic design. If we think about market competitiveness and operational excellence, particularly for our listeners, how do these multiplier effects impact what's possible for industries that are seeking a new and sustainable competitive advantage, right? Really highly differentiated competitive advantage. Maybe unpack some of that pre-processing and in kind of strategic design of the entire life cycle.
Sure.
In a way that other sectors might be able to draw those lessons.
Yeah. Maybe just because I don't have the time to explain and the visuals to explain really what we did in that study, but just to kind of make it simplified a little bit, just for the sake of the time, right? So if we look into a recycling process for textile, but it can be also for any kind of product or type of material, a certain recycling process is limited and bounded by efficiency and yields. And that means how much I put as an input, how much I get as an output, how much byproduct or waste is generated during this process, right? So a perfect process is that an ideal process, if I have 100% input, I will have 100% output without losing anything. And that relies on the material, mostly on the material purity, right? If a pre-processing precedes this step and increases the purity and the volume of the material received by this recycler, then eventually the yield will be impacted. Right. So let's say if we take a garment as is and then give it to the recycler, and this recycler, imagine it's a chemical recycler where they can put the whole product in, increase temperature, add some chemicals. Okay. It's becoming a solution. Some residues goes on the bottom. I'll take the top part. I'm just simplifying, right? Take top part and I can extract new fibers from that. Yeah. That's in terms of percentage, but how much waste you will lose in that because you didn't receive a pure material. It's different than you're using 100% of what you need with less impurity as much as possible to increase your process efficiency and therefore the yields. And when we know that a yield increase, it's a financial increase. It is tied to a financial benefit. And therefore, it makes the process much more viable. And this is very much needed now. Why? Because especially for products and raw material for the textile, virgin polyester is still cheaper than recycled one. And this is a fact because it's a fossil fuel product and it's still available. It's cheap. So the recycled fiber will be more expensive than the virgin one. And therefore, you need to make your processes more efficient, your yields higher and better to correct this financial business case for the recyclers and therefore for the whole ecosystem for it to work.
Yeah, so brilliant. So brilliant. And certainly a parallel that our listeners in so many sectors can kind of take back to their own ecosystems. And if we think about kind of where this is headed and maybe shifting gear just a little bit, Rawa, but if you're working at the intersection of innovation science, policy development, and market transformation. How exciting is that? What excites you most about the competitive opportunities and market leadership potential that you see emerging in the next 5, 10, 50 years based on these transformations that you're leading and experimenting?
I mean, that's a very, very good question. I wouldn't go for 50 because that's in such a fast-paced life that we cannot really imagine how it will look like. I would say 5-10 years. Yeah, I think it would be very interesting to see markets that are competitive, that are resilient to the shocks of the value chain, self-sufficient, needless to say, autonomous, where jobs are created rather than everything is automized, but also there's a lot of room for job creation, for even fueling innovation, spillovers. And what would be more interesting is the collaboration between the different industries. I think that will this synergy has never happened before. And I think this kind of shift and this policy and systemic shift in the ecosystem will pave the way for this to exist. And we will see better innovation, more efficient innovation that makes profit. It's better for the planet and the people.
No doubt, no doubt. And it's really exciting to think forward and the potential scenarios that are now being unlocked by these new models, by these new technologies, and the connection opportunities that they represent. For our listeners as our innovators, they're futurists, they're market makers, they're business leaders, engineers, researchers, policymakers. What is the one strategic insight that, if you can leave just one, you've given them many, but the one strategic insight you want them to start thinking about differently after hearing about your work and the economic opportunities that it represents?
I think if I just limited to one, I would go with that circularity is not a material issue. It's really a design issue, and it needs really to be treated at early stage at the get-go rather than really fixed at the end stage. And when we shift this mindset, everything else follows suit.
No doubt. No doubt. So right. And finally, I know we're coming up on the top of the hour here. So finally, as we're thinking about building the resilient ecosystemic models, both terrestrially and for the space economy, what role do you see this convergence of digital coordination, operational efficiency, and stakeholder orchestration playing in humanity's strategic and economic future, whether that's transitioning from linear to ecosystemic models here or designing truly efficient and circular operational ecosystems for space exploration and expansion?
That's a very good one. I think it provides a lot of economic resilience and growth to start first with, because we need this driver to push things. And definitely the more innovative solution and technology transfer where a new maybe infrastructure will be developed, where it's more stronger and allows the shift between linear system into a circular system. And therefore, it is the spirit of ecosystemic change.
I love that. So right. My goodness, you've given our listeners so many great examples that can easily transcend the boundaries of sector applications. So I think that our listeners have a lot of food for thought, a lot of paradigm kind of challenging that pressure testing that they need to go back and do, and some great examples that they can take back to their own applications, whether they're product managers or operational leaders or designers, futurists. There's a lot of great insight here that you've left them with. So thank you so much, Rawa. And thanks again to everyone for joining us today. And I hope you've enjoyed this conversation as much as we have. And you have a lot of great material to take back into your own day-to-day work. And I'm really pleased to, again, as always, check out this season's new episodes as we explore the convergence of innovation, technology, and refactor business models, and how this convergence is reshaping industry, policy, and society, and what it means for our collective ecosystemic futures. Follow us and subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or your preferred podcast platform. And as always, you can learn more about Shosham, about this and the work, the great work that our experts are leading at ShoshamWorks.com. Thanks again, Rawa. Amazing conversation.
Pleasure being here.